This is a very quiet Sunday, so I'm going to reminisce for about 40 seconds. I looked out at all of you and remembered something I had not thought about for quite a while. When I was 19 years old, in basic training at Clinton, Iowa, through a bitterly cold winter, living in tar paper shacks, every Sunday morning through that winter, I rode a little 6-passenger bus across the frozen wastelands to Rockford, Illinois, where I preached to 7 people. So I want you to know that to me, you are a tremendous crowd. The first hint of my sermon topic this morning came several days ago when I saw a bumper sticker that fairly shouted the name Jesus in big, bold letters, followed by a line in smaller print, which I couldn't read until curiosity got me close enough to see the rest of it. Jesus, it said, save us from your followers. I could smile sympathetically because I understood that call for help. You know as well as I do that not everyone who goes to church becomes an attractive advertisement for what it offers. I read the sign and remembered a famous bishop who said, I believe in the Holy Catholic Church and sincerely regret that it does not at present exist. Obviously, a case can be made for cynicism about the church. But bumper stickers and bishops like to shock us with half-truth to make a point. And on the same day I saw the sign and recalled the bishop's words, I read another side of the truth about the church. I paraphrase the words of a gifted preacher named Fred Buechner, who talks about why people come to church and what they find or fail to find when they get here. They come, he says, to see their friends and be seen by them. They come out of habit because they have always come, and out of tradition because their ancestors came before them. They come to be entertained, maybe even to be edified. They come, even the ones who in their secret hearts believe very little, with the idea that just maybe there is a God who keeps track of who comes and who doesn't, and it's just as well to stay on his good side. Sometimes they enjoy themselves in church, and sometimes they are bored stiff. Sometimes they are set to thinking long thoughts about themselves and their lives. But as often as not, their minds probably wander off into the same anxieties, fantasies, and daydreams they would have lost themselves in if they had been riding a bus or waiting their turn at the dentist. And in all of this, he says, their ministers were probably not all that different. Sometimes their hearts were in it, and sometimes it was just a job to get done, a sermon to be preached, whether or not it was rooted in passionate feeling. Ministers and congregations both, this minister says, come to church year after year, and who is to say how, if at all, their lives are changed as a result? If you ask them on any given Sunday, they are likely to say they haven't changed all that much, yet they keep coming anyway, and beneath all the lesser reasons, so far beneath that they themselves are only half aware of it, there is a deep reason that is probably best summed up in the word hope. They come to get married, full of bravado and wisecracks, until a moment in the ceremony when they are suddenly vulnerable to the words that are being spoken, and their sophisticated eyes fill with tears. They come to christen their babies, not very sure about the theological side of that ceremony, but wanting the touch of the church's faith and love on the life of their beloved child. They come to bury their dead, filled with the love, guilt, sadness, or relief that are part of what death always is for the living. In other words, Buechner says, what they are essentially doing beneath this roof is offering up the most precious moments of their lives in the hope that there is a God to hallow them, a God to hear and seal their vows, to receive their children into his unimaginable kingdom, to welcome with mercy the beloved lives now lost to them. One sees them sitting in church, some uncomfortable in their Sunday best, a few of the older faces closed like doors, some of the younger faces apathetic, expecting nothing. But deep within those faces, farther down than their daydreams and boredom, there is the hope that somewhere, out of all the words and music and silences of this place, and out of a mystery even greater than the mystery of the cosmos itself, a voice that they would know from all other voices would speak their names and bless them. Well, that's beautiful stuff, said as eloquently as only a few can say such things. And I hope it's true, because I so much want it to be true. It happened more than once during my years at the university that some student, surprised to learn of my other profession, would ask, "Why are you wasting your life in the church?" Or as one put it even more bluntly, "Why are you throwing your life away by being a minister?" I tried to answer that in several ways, but the best answer may be a line from a novel called God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which says, if we can't find reasons and ways of treasuring human beings because they are human beings, we might as well rub them out. I believe that at its best, the church does this for more people than any other institution I know. So I've had the church on my mind even more than usual over the past few days, and these now are some of the things I would like to say to you. Last Sunday morning, while you were enjoying a fresh voice in this pulpit, Billy and I were visiting Mayflower Congregational Church in Oklahoma City. Sitting beside us were old and dear friends Paul and Peggy McGee, who had driven up from Dallas for a brief 24-hour reunion. We had arranged to meet at the church because the four of us wanted to see if the minister at Mayflower could challenge our minds and warm our hearts as well as he did the last time we heard him. We agreed that he did, and after worship, we invited him and his wife to lunch at a pleasant restaurant called Bellini's, where we lingered for a couple of hours over good food and happy talk. We reminisced about other times we spent together and caught up on how our scattered children were doing, but since three of us were ministers and the other three were ministers' wives, we got around inevitably to a topic never far from our hearts, the church, and the honor and challenge of being a part of it. We shared stories about the incredible mix of human beings found in all churches and how much confusion exists about exactly what a church is. especially the strange notion that those of us who go to church are supposed to be perfect, so that when we stumble, as in some way, great or small, we always do, it's seen as proof that church doesn't work, that organized religion is about as necessary as the human appendix. The truth is that every church, including this one, is imperfect from head to toe. The imperfection starts right here in the pulpit and goes all the way to the back row of seats in the balcony. It lasts all week, and it returns next Sunday, because people who come to church bring their people-ness right along with them. You'd think no one would expect otherwise, but somehow, especially when we start grading one another, we seem to forget how far we ourselves are from perfection. This exercise we have going on right now, called worship, is meant to be a battery charging station where we come in to be renewed and replenished so we can live our faith for another week in a difficult world. Church is not meant to be a kind of castle where we hide from things that threaten us, or worse, where we hide from ourselves. And it's not meant to be a cloister, one of those isolated places of religious seclusion where the inmates huddle together in such ritually good behavior that if we're not careful, we may all think we're starting to sprout wings. The three ministers and their three wives who sat around that table last Sunday had no illusions about themselves or the people they love and serve in their respective churches. There are no angels, we agreed, in the pulpit or in the pews. We are just Bill and Betty, George and Gladys, Sam and Sue. We may improve a little by coming to church, but the change is usually not sensational and not very consistent. We think we're climbing up the spiritual ladder, becoming more patient, more honest, more compassionate, and then our foot slips, and we're suddenly back down at the bottom of the ladder, where, of course, if we are seen, somebody is tempted to say, well, well, look who's down here, and to think I see her in church every Sunday morning. I suppose it's inevitable, in the simple beauty of a room like this, with the music and the prayers, the smiles and the friendly greetings, to start thinking we are as good as we feel. But that's a mistake that can have serious consequences, not the least of which is the sickness of spiritual pride. The church, in sober fact, is what it has been from the very beginning, a community of sinners. The main difference between them and the rest of the world being that they have admitted they need help and have come for healing. Not a one of us is completely well. You aren't. No matter how high your rank in church or how hard you work for it, I'm not, any more than anyone else who preaches. Oh, I forget that occasionally and start thinking I may have become finally what I'd like to be, but then I succumb to a moment of pettiness, or I get discouraged for no adequate reason, or I fail to show compassion when the need for it is a soft whisper, very easily missed. And in those moments, I am yanked back to the truth about myself as a part of the enterprise called church. Those other two ministers last Sunday, my friend and my son, agreed with me that what we should hope to be given credit for is not unique goodness, but simple honesty. Honesty about ourselves, first of all, because that is crucial. If we deceive ourselves, we deceive and do harm to those who trust us. We dare not pretend to some kind of unique personal sanctity, because if we do, our first snap of temper, our first failure to be kind or forgiving, turns us into hypocrites whose words will fall on deaf ears. And if the men and women who minister to churches must be honest above all else, so must the people be who listen to them, remembering that they too are the ones the great apostle had in mind when he said that all of us have missed the mark and fallen short of the glory of God. Pulpit and pew alike, we have to be honest about our close kinship with that man who came boldly to Jesus one day to say, "Lord, I believe," and then knew instantly that it was not the whole truth, that sometimes he didn't believe much at all. Instead of being horrified by that confession of doubt, Jesus was understanding. He had, after all, fought his own lonely battles and would soon wonder in his dying hour why God had forsaken him. Church has to be a place where those mood swings are lovingly understood, a place where, without condoning moral failure, we help and heal each other in the name of one who said, "My friends, if a person does something wrong, you who have the Spirit of Christ should get him quietly back on the right path and not with any feeling of superiority. Bear one another's burdens, for in this way you fulfill the law of Christ." I don't have to tell you that this is not always the way we handle other people's mistakes. Because, once again, we are not perfect. In the Apostle Paul's famous confession, we have not yet arrived. We've listened to the good news without really hearing it. I like the way Soren Kierkegaard describes what church is often like in one of his odd parables, where a community of ducks waddle off to duck church to hear the duck preacher. The duck preacher reminds them passionately how God has given them wings, marvelous wings, so that they can fly here and there and do good things, so that they can even soar into the very presence of God. All the ducks in the congregation quack, "Amen." After which they all leave and waddle back home. So does Kierkegaard remind us how much we are creatures of habit. Week after week, we sit in the same place, in the same pew, following an order of service we know by heart, listening to a sermon we assume is meant mostly for someone else. So had we gotten cynical, Paul and Robin and I, as we talked about the churches we have served? Not for a moment. And partly because if much of church life is routine, now and then something special happens, a serendipity, unplanned, unrehearsed. In the middle of a worship service, worship actually happens. Someone is touched by the majesty of the music and lifted up to to a better self. A friend of mine from Texas worshiped with us on a certain Sunday, and a year or so later, when I was reading one of his published essays, I came across these words. I once heard a choir in Wichita sing the battle hymn of the Republic, and as Christ was born across the sea, a solo trumpet came in and marked my life forever. The choir was ours, and the trumpeter that day was Walt Myers. You never know when a moment in church may turn into magic for someone. So in the words of one far more gifted than myself, I think it is hope that lies at our hearts and hope that finally brings us all here. Hope that in spite of the devastating evidence we can find to the contrary, the ground we stand on is holy ground because Christ walked here and walks here still. Hope that we are known, each of us by name, and that out of the burning moments of our lives, He will call us by our names to the lives He wants us to live and the selves He would have us become. Hope that into the secret pain and grief and bewilderment of each of us and of our world, He will come at last to heal and forgive. So on this first Sunday of a new year, with great joy in what has happened among us, together we lift up this church to the Lord of our lives, asking that He make Himself known in and through each of us so that we may do the work of love that makes life worth living. Dearly beloved, Happy New Year.